The scripture reading this evening will be from 2 Peter 1, 5 through 7. For this very reason, make every effort to add to your faith goodness, and to goodness knowledge, and to knowledge self-control, and to self-control perseverance, and to perseverance godliness, and to godliness brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness love.
The passage that Jackson's just read for us is a very familiar one and well worth our attention. That's not really the passage that we are going to be studying this evening. I'm going to use it only as an introduction. And there are many things that we might study about that passage and the interlinking of those kind of virtues, but I'll start with just one simple point from that, and that is it begins with faith and it concludes with love. And many have observed that that is an incredible monument to build to love, starting on the strong foundation of faith, adding all of those other virtues, and ending then with love, which is, in many estimations, one of the strongest forces in the world. Love was certainly strong enough to bring the creator of heaven and earth down into this world to die on a cross. And love in human affairs is strong enough to change people's lives, to ruin their lives, or to save their lives in many important ways. And with that introduction, I want to turn then to 1 Corinthians chapter 13, where the Apostle Paul does really talk about love there. And our particular concern in looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 13 this evening is the power of love, but particularly the power of love and personal relationships. Last week I preached about what is marriage, and a couple of people asked me if I would preach some more lessons on the topic of family relationships, and so particularly we want to look at this passage, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, in application to those relationships, though it's clear in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, that the Apostle Paul is suggesting love as the solution to the many troubles that are affecting the congregation there at Corinth, particularly as it begins with the divisions that exist among them. And then in 1 Corinthians 11, the abuse of the Lord's Supper caused by their snubbing one another in the Lord's Supper. And the solution to that is love. And so he says in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 in verse 1, if I speak with the tongues of men and of angels but do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to move mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. And if I give all of my possessions to feed the poor, and if I surrender my body to be burned, but do not have love, it profits me nothing. And then he speaks about the character of this love, which is so much greater than all of this charity, so much greater than all of this miraculous power, so much greater than all of this prophetic insight. And he says, love is patient, love is kind and is not jealous, love does not brag and is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly, it does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, rejoices with the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. And we'll stop right there and go back and consider those ideas about love. And there are 12, as I count them, particular ideas about the nature of love that have practical applications in all areas of our lives, to congregational life, to family life. And we want to think a little bit about those, because when you read that list, it's kind of like it just goes on. And the problem is it's so powerful, and each one of those points is so important that we just don't have the time to dwell on them. We probably should do so, and we'll take a little bit of time this evening to think about each one of those. And you recognize a little bit of time about each one of them, since there are 12. Usually in a sermon, there are 3 points. Sometimes in a long sermon, 5 points. But this time we have 12 points, so settle in. It's powerful stuff. Or maybe we can get halfway through and finish up then at another time. But let's think about this. First of all, he says about love, and of course he's talking about congregational love, but we can apply this to family relationships, that love suffers long, that love is patient, as some translations have it. This is kind of a passive virtue about love. The very next thing he says is that love is kind, and that's the more active application of this passive form. When he says that love is patient or love suffers long, he is suggesting that you have the power to avenge yourself on another person, but you really don't avail yourself of that power. You have the ability to strike out at the other person and to hurt them, but you refuse to do that. Of course, if you strike out at the other person, you start a cycle, a downward spiral of recriminations. But if you resist in that moment, then maybe there's a chance to heal the breach between the people in the congregation, or between the married couple, or between the children, or between the parents and the children. And we have, particularly in family relationships, though in congregational relationships as well, the power to hurt people. In fact, one of the things that we give to people when we marry is the power for them to hurt us, because we trust that they won't, and we hope that they love us enough that they won't. My dad used to say to me, "Son, don't argue with me. I know too much about you." And of course, that was true. And I was, I was completely abjectly in terror of that. He knew every one of my deepest and darkest secrets. It was not until I was like in my 20s I realized, hey, I know a lot about him too. But it's best if we don't say those things or use those things to hurt the other person. We need to be long-suffering with one another. We need to let the other person work their way through. We have the ability to leave the rights and the wrongs and the judgments to God and just to serve one another in love, in a congregation or in a family. Love suffers long is translated in some places as love is patient. And that's another kind of an aspect of the same idea, that love can wait. That love's not insistent upon an immediate solution to a problem. That love's not insistent upon getting its rights now. That love can wait. It can wear us down. It can wear us out. Or maybe better than that, it can build us up gradually over time. In fact, the best proof of love really is its willingness to wait. Its lack of impatience with the other person. Example of that would be perhaps, I don't know, maybe one of the good examples out of the book of Genesis, chapter 29, Jacob. And it says of Jacob that he worked 7 years for Rachel. 7 years he worked for her. Wanda's father didn't make me work 7 years. He just said, okay. And Jacob worked 7 years, but it says about that, it seemed as only a few days to him. Because of the love that he had for her. He was patient. If he could be patient for 7 years, we ought to learn to be patient for at least a few minutes or a few days with those that we love. Love suffers long. It is patient. And the other side of that, number two, is that love is kind. It's more active form of this same sort of expression of love. It is sweet to the other person instead of being critical of the other person. It is encouraging to the other person as opposed to being discouraging or tearing them down. In Proverbs 31, the proverb that describes the worthy woman, lots of wonderful things are said about her there, about how industrious she is and how concerned she is. But one of the things that may be most important for making a family a happy family is when it says in the 26th verse of the 31st proverb, she opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. She says kind things to the people in her household, and hopefully they return that kindness to her. Kindness, how important it is for us on a daily basis to do the little things that are kind things. You know, sometimes people think about love in our society. We focus on big things and great things. You know, it's like maybe with Naaman, and he wanted to get cleansed of his leprosy, and the prophet said to him, dip in the River Jordan, and he got upset, and he said, if he'd asked me to do some great thing, I would have done it. I'd climb the highest mountain. I'd swim the deepest ocean. for you, but no, little things like holding the door or being attentive and saying nice things, that's a little too much. You know, the big things, well, that's what the proverb says too, the eyes of the fool are on the ends of the earth, in the sense that he forgets the daily kinds of things. There's a difference between the things that are important and the things that are urgent in our lives. And very frequently we get caught up with the urgent things. But those are not always the important things. The important things are the people in our lives, people in our congregation, people in our family. And we need to get those things done too, instead of letting the urgent distract us from that. And we ought to be sensitive to this virtue of kindness too. We ought to appreciate it in other people. Some people seem, you know, to be more appreciative, and maybe this is inappropriate about that, I don't know, but I always thought, you know, the women seem like they appreciate the guy that's mean to them some instead of the guy that's kind. But we ought to appreciate the virtue of kindness as well as being kind ourselves. And I'll tell you this, you know, the mistreatment, the rough handling, the impatience are not going to bode well for a long-term relationship. That can get pretty old pretty fast. Kindness, however, becomes more and more important and more valuable over the years. That's what drew Boaz, you know, to Ruth when he observed in chapter 2 of the book of Ruth the kindness that she demonstrated to her mother-in-law. And any man with any sense at all would say, that's the kind of wife I want, one who is kind in that way. And of course, Boaz was kind to her in turn. When Abraham entrusted his servant, which strikes us as pretty strange, to go get a wife for his son, he sent this servant way back to where the parents of his homeland were. And you know how that servant chose the bride for Isaac? Well, he chose her on the basis of kindness. In fact, he says in Genesis 24, verse 14, this is what I'm going to do. If a young woman says to me, please let me put your pitcher down and give water for you and drink for your animals too, then he says, by that I will know that he has shown kindness to my master. Not only kindness to him and kindness to his animals, but kindness to Abraham and kindness to Isaac. That's the test of what is really valuable in the people that we ought to make close to us. That's the kind of person we ought to be to those that are important to us, in our family and in our congregation. 3, love does not envy. Or some translations say, love is not jealous. Love doesn't begrudge the other person. Love always rejoices with the other person. I mean, it seems fairly obvious. If you love somebody, you should be happy when good things happen to them. We should be happy when our friends get rewards, when they get awards, when they get a promotion. We should be ready to rejoice with them. But that seemed like maybe not always the case. Sometimes it seems like we're a little bit kind of suspicious of the other person. We need to be happy for those that we love. We need to be like the Apostle Paul, who says of his relationship with the Corinthians, I was ready to spend and to be spent on your behalf. He ought to be like the relationship that he sees ideally, parents and children. It's not for the children to lay up for the parents, but the parents to lay up for the children. In fact, that's really the way it goes when we have love for another person and we have resources that we want to do things for the other person. We ought to be happy for them instead of envious of them. Well, of course, then you think about sibling rivalry, and that's one of the things that's kind of always a problem, is when, you know, brothers or sisters are envious when the other one gets some good thing in life. You know, that's a big part of the growing up process, to learn that, you know, they've matured when they can be happy when their brother or their sister or sibling of some kind has some good thing happen to them. Love is not envious. It's not jealous. This is another translation of the same kind of word. It has a different kind of an idea. But you would think, yeah, Love ought not to be jealous of the other person. It's clearly the case that God is jealous of Israel, as he describes Israel as his espoused bride. And a man has a right to expect an exclusive relationship. Exclusively, the love of his wife should be directed toward him. And that's true of wives, too. They have the right to expect that of their husbands. But really, I think what it's saying here, if we translate it as love is not jealous, is not that it is never jealous. Gee, if you really love somebody, especially in that exclusive pair bond relationship, you're going to feel a little jealousy once in a while, but not the kind of jealousy that destroys the relationship. It is the kind of love that trusts the other person and is not jealous without a cause. And, of course, if the other person's kind, they recognize that jealousy. They don't use it, but they are kind and don't provoke to jealousy. 4, it does not parade itself. It does not brag. It is not puffed up. It is not arrogant. That's the nature of love. Love is not self-centered. Love is not the kind of feeling that looks down on the other person. Love is not, in a sense, going to feel that it's better than the other person. Love is always aware in some ways of its own unworthiness. Now that flies in the face of modern wisdom and the emphasis on self-esteem, and somewhere they found in the scriptures back in the 1960s that you have to love yourself before you can love somebody else. I don't think that's really there, but that's what they thought and that's what they teach today. But that's not really the biblical perspective about love, and that's not really what love is. Love is the kind of feeling that gets up every morning and says, I can't believe that I have this wife. I can't believe I have this husband. I can't believe that I have this life, these children, these parents. The Bible emphasizes the humility of love. It's always aware of how blessed it is. Love is never the kind of thought that says, little nagging suspicion, I deserve better than this. The little nagging seed of destruction that says, I could have done better than this. There is no hope for that kind of relationship. The Bible talks about love as not parading itself, of not being arrogant, of not being puffed up, really of being humble. And along with that, it's not rude. Doesn't behave unseemly, some of the translations have. Unseemly suggests maybe a stronger kind of a form of behavior that's condemned, but I think the better translation is that it's not rude, that it doesn't hurt the other person's feeling. You know, today, once again, one of the emphasis on marital relationships is honesty. We need to be honest with one another. And that's true. You don't want to lie. On the other hand, as one man said, my marriage has been saved by, being able to speak honestly. The other man says, my marriage has been saved by things I haven't said. There's some things that are true right now for the moment, but it's best not to say them. They may not be true about your feelings in the next moment, but don't say them because, they can't get them back. Once your feelings have changed about that, there is a grace in truth that looks to the other person's well-being. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 8, where Peter's talking about husband-wife relationship, and then by verse 8, he seems like he's expanded that to broader relationships, but really the same application is there too. 1 Peter 3 and verse 8, finally, all of you be of one mind, having compassion for one another, love as brothers, and be tenderhearted and be courteous. Just courteous. And, that's kind of a thing that we've lost in our society today. Civility, courtesy, manners. In fact, one translation has this, love has good manners. And, of course, good manners isn't necessarily about dressing for dinner. In the way of the Jane Austen novels, manners is more about treating the other person with the kind of respect that they deserve, treating the situation with the respect that it deserves. We have some discussions about what's the appropriate dress for attending services. I'm not sure whether you can lay down any hard and fast rules about that, but do you treat the occasion with the respect that it deserves? And really, in terms of relationship, husbands, wives, parents, and children, do you give them the respect that they deserve? Are you courteous to them as opposed to being rude? Rudeness always comes out of being self-centered and thinking about oneself. When you think about the other person, then you put proper emphasis on the relationship and the situation, and you're courteous and kind in that situation. And really, that's the essence of the gospel, isn't it? The golden rule to treat others as we would want them to treat us. That means you have to think about the other person and what they want. I was with my sister and brother-in-law this weekend, and they were reminding me, you know, what they call the shotgun gifts. I'm not sure this is really true, but it is the myth of the family that one year my dad gave mom a shotgun for Christmas. And, of course, she'd never shot a gun in her life. So he got to use the shotgun. So, but, you know, that's not really what doing to others as you would have them do unto you, it would be. You know, it's you've got to put yourself in the other person's point of view. And that really is what courtesy and kindness is all about. Love is never rude. Love does not seek its own. Love does not insist on having its own way. Now, you know, that's kind of a natural human tendency, amplified in some people, wanting to have your own way and wanting to do it your way. But the essence of love really is to see the other person's point of view, to see it from their point of view, and to see their good as the greater aim rather than your own good. You know, when people today say, "I love you," I'm not sure exactly what they mean. I don't think they know exactly what they mean. Love's one of those kind of words that's a catch-all sort of word. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 probably doesn't enter the mind of most of those people who write the script for Hollywood that are then repeated by young people around the country, around the world, when they're in some kind of paired relationship. But when they say, "I love you," I think sometimes what they mean is, "I love me, and I want you to be good to me." But I could be wrong about that. I don't know exactly what they mean. But I do know what this means. This means that you don't seek your own. You don't insist on having your own way. You're not really concerned about whether you're going to be happy. You're concerned about whether the other person's going to be happy. That's why you get married. It's not so somebody else can make you happy. You get married to make somebody else happy. It's the essence, you know, really, when we talk about parental love. You know, parents give up for their children. They sacrifice for their children. Well, I hope they do. That's the way we think about it. Mother love. Of course, sometimes, you know, we look at society today and, you know, it's pretty clear some parents don't love their children that way. You know, they don't sacrifice for their children. But I was blessed with parents and grew up, that was just the way they thought about it. I mean, you know, if the children needed shoes or the children needed clothes or they needed money for some kind of fees for some activity, then that's what the money went for. Not for what they wanted, but for what their children needed. Love does not insist on its own. It doesn't think about itself. It thinks about the other person. When somebody says, "I love you," and then they use that to try and get you to do things that are not in your own best interest, you know, they really don't love you. Maybe they don't understand the situation, but mostly it's probably they just don't love you. They love themselves. I mean, we ought to have an application in the church, in the family, of Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 through 4. You know, these are all passages that we're so very familiar with, but do we make the real application of those in day-to-day life? Philippians 2 and verse 3, "Do nothing from selfishness." And it's like, how many times have we read that, you know, and how few times have we really acted that way? And even if we acted that way for a whole week, you know, we know pretty soon we're going to mess it up, because he says, "Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, you regard the other person as more important than yourselves." Boy, it sounds like you don't even want to read that passage when you start thinking about what it means and how far short we fall of that. Do not merely look out for your own interest, but also the interest of others. Love does not seek its own, doesn't insist on having its own way, is willing to step aside and let the other person go first. 6, love is not easily provoked. Love is not irritable. It doesn't lose its temper. Love doesn't get exasperated. Somebody once said that to lose your temper with another person is to give up on that person. And you ought never to give up on a person that you love. You never ought to let them think that you have given up on them because you've lost your temper with them. Drummond, writing about this passage many years ago, said, "No form of vice, nor worldliness, nor greed of gold, nor drunkenness itself does more to," you may not like this word, but you get the point, "unchristianize society than evil temper." Drunkenness, greed, vice, worldliness, he said, you know, those are bad, but they are not as bad at unchristianizing, at taking Christ out of people's lives, than evil temper is. You know, and why is that the case? And no, I think it goes back to the same issue that really a lot of us focused on, and that is self-centeredness. Because why do people lose their temper? Why are people grouchy? Why are they easily exasperated and easily provoked? Why are they touchy? It's because they're self-centered, because they're not getting their way. If they were much more concerned about other people, then they wouldn't be so grouchy and so irritable all the time. Some people will say, well, Christ was angry. And then other people say, well, he was righteously indignant. Eh, I don't care what you call it about that. Christ was upset, but not without cause. But he wasn't really irritable. You know, he just wasn't easily provoked. I mean, it took a lot for him to get upset with those money changers and, you know, take a quirt and drive them out of the temple. That was a pretty big thing they had done. But he wasn't like, you know, you have to be careful around him because, you know, he's in a bad mood today. Irritable, touchy, quirky. You know, that's not the way love is. If you really love people, then you're not touchy and irritable like that. It's like, I think probably I should just quit right here because, you know, I don't know whether we want to read any more of this or not, or whether I have any right to be reading it to you or not. Because, you know, this is like the stuff we read over and over again. But when you get right down to where are we and how do we live this, you know, it is not easy to live this way. No wonder Paul said, you know, this is important stuff. If I have prophecy, if I have miraculous powers, if I have tongues of men and angels, if I have the greatest charitable deeds in the history of the world, I'm nothing unless I can master these kind of things. Well, I think we'll just leave it there for today. I've had about all I can take of this. I don't know about the rest of you, but get somebody else to offer the invitation so I can come forward. Maybe we'll pick this up next time, but we've run out of time for tonight. But I will say this, and really I kind of started with this, John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life." God sacrificed his Son for you and me. And, you know, doesn't matter that we were unworthy. Doesn't matter that we are unworthy on a daily basis. He loves us. And he gave up his Son for us to save us. And you just have to be moved by that. You have to respond to that. You have to say, "Jesus, I come." Because that's all you can say. Not because I'm worthy. Not because I've done great deeds. But because that's what I need. and thank God for Jesus. If you're here this evening and you need to respond to his invitation, we encourage you and encourage one another as we stand and sing this song.